again to the Conversations That Matter podcast. I'm your host, John Harris, and we have a special guest who's been on the podcast once before, but someone I very much appreciate. I actually like to check my math against him. If I have a certain political take and this particular person agrees with me, I always feel a little bit better about it because Daniel McCarthy is a very smart individual, but he's, I think, stellar when it comes to analyzing the political situation, including things like foreign policy, which is what we're going to talk about a little bit today. He is the a distinguished fellow at the Heritage Foundation. He's also the editor of Modern Age. And if you don't have Modern Age, if you aren't subscribed, if you don't go to the website, I would encourage you to do so. It'll make you a lot smarter when it comes to politics. So without further ado, Daniel McCarthy, thank you for being here and talking to us about foreign policy a little bit.
Thanks, John.
So you wrote a piece for Compact Magazine on the Massey defeat, but it was really more about the Republican Party and conservative movement and their lack of foreign policy vision post-Reagan. And I'm simplifying it, but you go through each administration and describe, I think, perfectly where the Republican Party was at that particular time post-Reagan. And then bringing us to our moment now, where we have someone, Thomas Massey, who has been compared to Ron Paul a lot with his foreign policy vision. But this is not the policy or the philosophy that the Republican Party is necessarily interested in at the moment. They're more interested in Trump's kind of peace through strength, strong foreign policy, but obviously it's not a neocon foreign policy. So what I'm hoping to do is maybe flesh out some of that piece, connect the dots for viewers, most of whom are going to be probably conservatives and Christians who vote Republican generally. Some of them might not be happy that Massey lost. And just to give them some context for all of this. So we could do this sequentially. That's probably the best way to start off and then bring it home to what just happened last week. So maybe post-Cold War, what was the policy of the conservative movement, Republican Party, up until the time of Reagan? You didn't really cover this, but pre-Reagan, what were conservatives saying about our relationship with other countries around the world?
Well, up to Ronald Reagan, the Cold War was the predominant fact in the way conservatives thought about foreign policy. The Soviet Union was not just a military threat, it was also an ideological antithesis to the United States. It was an ideological antithesis to Christianity. Across the board, the Soviet Union represented, again, not just a worldly opponent, but also a very different worldview that conservatives rejected. And therefore, conservatives generally favored military strength in the United States. They, tended to be, in some ways quite hawkish, but really they were more anti-communist. They were concerned about the ideological threat even more than they were eager to get into foreign countries and fight wars there. So something like Vietnam, interestingly enough, is a war that gets started under Democratic administrations and obviously, sort of becomes a major issue under the Lyndon Johnson administration, in the 1960s. So conservatives were not necessarily, demented war hawks or anything like that, as they're often portrayed by their progressive enemies. And progressives tried to present Ronald Reagan that way, too. They said, oh, Ronald Reagan would blow up the world if he got a chance. You know, this guy's dangerous. He shouldn't have his hand on the nuclear button. He's going to get us into wars. In fact, what Reagan actually did was to have a very prudent foreign policy. He put pressure on the Soviet Union, especially when it came to spending on new weapon systems and new technologies, like the idea of space-based defense. He also was willing to support various resistance movements against communism in Central Asia, in Afghanistan, for example, and in Latin America. But he was not, in fact, bringing us to the brink of a nuclear war with the Soviet Union. He was not, in fact, about to, send NATO troops marching across the borders into Eastern Europe. On the contrary, Reagan was setting things up so that the Soviet Union would collapse of its own entropy and that basically its own tyranny over the Eastern Europeans and the Russians themselves would bring it down. And that was very successful.
Was there a difference initially post-World War II between Republicans and Democrats on foreign policy, or did that become more of a contrast as Democrats were a little bit more aligned or soft on the Soviet Union?
Well, that's a great point, because the Franklin Roosevelt administration really was infiltrated by people who were quite pro-communist and very soft on the Soviet Union indeed. And as a result, coming out of World War II, conservatives were very critical of the Democratic Party, which they saw as being a party of basically surrendering to Stalin. And even after Roosevelt dies and he's succeeded by Harry Truman, who is somewhat more aggressive at taking on communist infiltration at home and also sees the Soviet Union abroad as a big threat, the conservative movement is still very critical of Harry Truman. They see him really as being in the shadow of Franklin Roosevelt. But that said, there are, you know, a lot of dimensions to the way early conservatives after World War II think about foreign policy. And even though they want to have a, you know, they want to have a clear moral understanding of the Soviet Union as an opponent, exactly what form of resistance to the Soviet Union that's going to take, there are, you know, several ideas that are floating around. They certainly generally support more of a military buildup, although President Eisenhower sees that as a problem. He thinks the country is going to bankrupt itself. So conservatives were worried about that too, and they, you know, they looked for cheaper ways to deter Soviet aggression rather than having, you know, repeats of things like the Korean War. They thought perhaps we should strengthen our nuclear arsenal and also use covert operations in places like Guatemala and Iran and elsewhere, which is one of the things that opens the door to some of what the CIA, you know, gets involved in over the course of the Cold War.
So that brings us to Ronald Reagan, and he has a piece through Strength Vision that resonates with conservatives, obviously credited with winning the Cold War, helping win it. And then after Reagan, you make the case that this mentality continues through Bush, but it's different than obviously the MAGA Trump approach. So maybe contrast that for us. What makes George W. Bush different than Trump? And are they reading Reagan in different ways? Because they both claim that they're like Reagan.
Right. So there's this great, you know, kind of intellectual civil war among conservatives after the end of the Cold War. And, you know, because so much of conservative foreign policy thinking has been shaped for decades at that point by the conditions of the Cold War, once the Soviet Union is no longer around, the question becomes, well, what should our attitude towards the world be now? Should we, in fact, be much more focused on the United States, much less committed to international institutions like NATO? That's what one side says. The other side says, well, actually, the world perhaps is less ordered now because you don't have, you know, this superpower conflict. And because of the potential for disorder, the United States now has to actually take a more active role in perhaps policing faraway conflicts. And, you know, the George H.W. Bush administration generally favors, you know, continuing to have a very, you know, a very active role around the world in foreign policy. And you see that with the Persian Gulf War. You'll see it eventually with rounds of not just maintaining NATO, which is one thing, but also as you get into the Clinton administration, expansion of NATO as well, which George H.W. Bush was in favor of too. When you get to the George W. Bush administration in the early 2000s, Bush has, you know, become president. You know, he is presenting himself not just as an heir to his own father, but also an heir to Ronald Reagan. And he and a number of people who come to be called neoconservatives and who, in many cases, self-identify as neoconservatives are saying, you know, quite explicitly, well, we believe that you have to have a very, you know, sort of engaged foreign policy. And of course, after 9/11, the whole country agrees with that. The whole country says, well, yes, you know, the United States needs to fight a war on terror. That means we need to be, you know, not just in places like Afghanistan, but also perhaps in Iraq. And then it turns out that, you know, George W. Bush doesn't really have a plan for what to do once you've, you know, taken on hostile regimes in Iraq and Afghanistan. And so what winds up happening is that this idea that every nation state should be democratic and liberal and kind of like us, this is the vision that George W. Bush winds up pursuing in Afghanistan and Iraq. And we get these decades-long occupations, which are aimed at not just, you know, knocking out a regime that's hostile to us, but actually trying to build some sort of liberal democracy in those places.
And then Trump.
Well, and that, yes, indeed. So Trump is, you know, he recognizes that the American people do not have the patience, and it's, you know, it's correct that they don't have the patience to permanently occupy, you know, these faraway countries, which in fact are very resistant to becoming culturally and, you know, politically like us. He recognizes that these are what critics have been calling forever wars. And he says, you know, when we think about America getting to war, our objective should be to win, and our objective should be able to point to something and say, this is what we have been able to get out of the war. Whereas if you have, you know, conflicts like Iraq and Afghanistan, it's not clear, you know, what exactly we have in the long run taken, you know, in terms of making America more powerful from these decades-long occupations. There's no end in sight when Trump first becomes president in 2016, 2017. There's no end in sight to what we're doing in Afghanistan. So Trump, you know, appeals to people who Americans who say we should have a less engaged foreign policy, a less activist foreign policy abroad, and that we should, in fact, you know, be much more limited in terms of the wars we choose to fight. And when we fight them, we should fight them in order to win and to win quickly rather than having prolonged occupations.
When you look back at oftentimes it's George Washington's foreign policy and not to get involved in foreign entanglements, or John C. Calhoun, who, I mean, he was a war hawk at first, but then he's against the Mexican-American War. These are figures that are sort of summoned from the past to teach us what real conservatives think about these things, or in the 20th century, is it Robert Taft? I think it's Robert Taft, the Republican who's very against getting involved in foreign affairs too much. And I know that the side that is very, very against all the bases we have and the wars that we fight and all of that, they like to go to the past and try to pick out these examples to say these were the authentic conservatives. Maybe talk about that a little bit before we get to Massey. Is there an authentic conservatism? Can the real authentic conservatives stand up and tell us what the foreign policy objective is? Or is this very complicated and our circumstances different? And you know, Trump inherited something that obviously he didn't create. So just try to peel back some onion layers for us, because I see this very oversimplified, in my opinion. And I think you'd be a great person to just flesh out what the conservative approach to foreign policy is.
Well, we're definitely right to look back to our own history for some guidance, even though America's current position in the world is somewhat different from that of our country at the time of the founding. George Washington is indeed someone I think that we can always, you know, find wisdom in. It's interesting to look back at the circumstances of his neutrality proclamation. So his neutrality proclamation, this is around, you know, this is in the 1790s. It is really an attempt to keep us out of what is basically a European war. You could even argue it was a world war, this conflict between revolutionary France and Great Britain. There are Americans, including Thomas Jefferson, who are quite eager for us to support the French side of that conflict. Not necessarily to get into armed conflict immediately, but Jefferson thinks that, you know, the French Revolutionary cause is the cause of liberalism, the cause of, you know, what we would now call liberal democracy. And Jefferson still identifies the British as with, you know, monarchy and with, you know, everything that, you know, he believes the American Revolution was fought against. Adding to this is the fact that we have a treaty of alliance with France. France came to our aid during the Revolutionary War. We signed a treaty of mutual defense. And so Jefferson and, you know, his side of politics is saying America has a treaty duty to support its ally here. And George Washington, you know, he says that no, we're not. We're going to, you know, call ourselves neutral. Alexander Hamilton makes an argument that actually the you know, France that we had a treaty with was the France of Louis XVI, and now that he has been deposed, it's a completely different regime in France, and therefore our treaty obligations don't continue. It's controversial, by the way, and it speaks to something that a lot of you know, conservatives and libertarians talk about even now in the 21st century, which is to what degree can the executive simply unilaterally set foreign policy, and to what extent you know, is what the Constitution says about you know, Congress's power to declare war. Just how far does that go? How binding is that? Because Jefferson and James Madison both make the argument that George Washington doesn't constitutionally have the power to declare neutrality. They say that if you need Congress to declare war, then you also need Congress to declare that we're not going to war, that we're going to be neutral, and that in fact, you know, neutrality can have a lot of effects on a, you know, foreign conflict, which may in fact favor one side over another. And so Jefferson and Madison are both, you know, they both think that Washington has chosen a policy that's going to favor the British and harm France, even though it's a policy officially of neutrality. So it's a very complicated situation. And just as you have to think through the complexities of modern 21st century foreign policy, when you go back and look at what George Washington, you know, had to do in the foreign policy of our very first presidential administration, he too faced a complex situation, and he too was accused of many of the same things that a president like Trump is accused of being, you know, of using executive power in too broad of a way. And there are, you know, sort of great controversies here, including a controversy over who was actually trying to seek peace, right? So Washington and Hamilton thought that they were, you know, doing the right thing by keeping America as, you know, as much out of the conflict as possible. Jefferson and Madison thought, well, really what you're doing is you're weakening France and you're strengthening Britain because you're maintaining these, you know, trade ties with Britain. And therefore, you're actually kind of entering the war on the side of the bad guys, and you shouldn't do that. So there's more complexity to that than, you know, a lot of retrospective views would suggest. As you say, in the Cold War, even there were figures like Robert Taft, who is a senator from Ohio, who was very critical of NATO, very critical of, you know, the idea that we would have to have a global crusade against communism. So there was, you know, indeed conservative thinking, which said that actually we still need to look back on this 19th century tradition that is less interventionist rather than, you know, think about, you know, the Cold War as being something that is setting the stage for World War III, or that otherwise is going to be a long-term commitment that might bankrupt us. That was certainly one of Robert Taft's fears. And you can see how, you know, some of these threads continue into various Republican figures today. You can see some of it in Ron Paul. You can certainly see some of it in Thomas Massey, and others too. It's not just libertarian-leaning Republicans, but there is, you know, a true and honorable sense of, you know, restraint in foreign policy that is very conservative as well as quite libertarian. The irony, of course, being a lot of libertarians like Thomas Jefferson, even though Thomas Jefferson, you know, James Madison's the one who, you know, is Jefferson's disciple and finally gets us actually into, you know, a major foreign war, which is the War of 1812, where the United States declares war on Britain and invades Canada. And of course, that doesn't work out so well for us. So yes, there is a conservative tradition of foreign policy restraint in America, but it has to be applied intelligently at every step of the way. It's not simply a matter of thinking that you can do exactly as George Washington did, because even Washington, what he did was controversial in his day.
The closest I've gotten to trying to understand what a conservative singular position on this would be from the American's perspective is Calhoun, because Calhoun, it has a problem with the British intercepting our ships, conscripting our sailors. He thinks this is a violation of the honor of the United States. And that's one of the chief reasons in my reading that he's a war hawk. But then later he, of course, is against the Mexican-American War. He's doesn't want a war with England over the 38th parallel. And he tries to basically say that a war for the sake of territory expansion is a wrong motive. And so the difference that I saw in him was that if our honor is abridged somehow, we have an obligation to answer that. Like we're just being disrespected on the world stage, which maybe is a very Southern thing anyway. Although I know there are people who disagreed with him from the South. Like I think even John Randolph, I think, disagreed with him about the War of 1812.
Yes. But, and in fact, that's worth commenting on. So you're exactly right that someone like Calhoun is a figure well worth, you know, taking a very close look at. And again, you know, people might be confused because he's very hawkish in 1812, but then less so later on. And John Randolph of Roanoke, who is a kinsman of Thomas Jefferson, but is very critical. He thinks that Jefferson is in many ways not Jeffersonian enough. But Randolph of Roanoke is also very sympathetic to the more conservative line of thought coming from someone like Edmund Burke in the UK. Randolph of Roanoke, he's very critical of his fellow Southerners. Randolph of Roanoke is against the War of 1812. And he says that this war is basically, it's about economics, and it's about the fact that Southern economic interests are being harmed by, you know, they were harmed by the embargo that Thomas Jefferson had pursued to try to keep, you know, America separated mostly from Britain, British economic power. That was bad for Southern, you know, economic interests. And as an alternative to this kind of economic warfare or economic embargo in place of war, which Jefferson had pursued, the a lot of Southerners in Congress by the Madison administration, they're saying, well, look, you know, the embargo hasn't worked. What can we do instead? We've got to end this problem. Let's have a war against, you know, Canada. Let's take out, you know, the British to our north, and then we won't be held hostage. Our trade won't be held hostage by British power. So Randolph thinks that is, you know, very important, and he, you know, doesn't really credit other Southerners' views about honor. Not that he doesn't believe in honor himself, he very much does, but he thinks that, you know, other Southerners are basically being deceitful and have motives that are quite different. Which is just to say, I mean, you know, all of America's wars, you can have some very, you know, very intelligent, very principled people who wind up being on opposite sides and having very different interpretations of why we're doing these conflicts and getting into them, which is just another reason to, you know, take these things seriously and not think you can paint with a broad brush.
Well, I could just envision Calhoun, which is always dangerous to do, I suppose, to take these historical figures and cast them in present situations. But I could envision him seeing the Ayatollah Khamenei and seeing the Death to America chants using their forces while we were in places like Iraq to attack us and their proxies and saying, you know what, this is an abridgment of our honor. This is a threat to our trade, even on the global stage, like being supportive. But at the same time, it's a very different situation, obviously, with military bases in a region that he never probably would have conceived of us ever having military bases. And so this is where, in my mind, it gets very tricky. And I admit, one of the reasons I wanted to have you on is I myself go back and forth and am confused sometimes just because I value the small government argument of like, let's reel it back. But then you look at it and it's a knot and you think to yourself, well, who's going to occupy the space that we're leaving? Is it China? Is it one of our enemies? Is it possible to do this? I want to do it. But then when you have regimes that are threatening us in massive ways, attempting to seek nuclear weapons that they will, in fact, most likely use, that kind of thing, then yeah, it does seem like that merits a response. So any thoughts there with just kind of the situation that we've inherited as a result of post-war activity, Cold War policy? How do you see the United States on the world stage today? And if we wanted to reel it back, what would we even do? I don't even know how we get started in doing that.
Well, you're right. Not only is there the question of whether rivals or opponents are going to fill a vacuum, you know, if we're not playing the, you know, sort of expansive role that we've been playing recently, even if our allies fill that vacuum, it turns out that there are risks involved with that too. And you're kind of seeing that play out right now in the Middle East. So Israel has, you know, very grave, you know, security concerns with Iran. For us, you know, Iran is a troublemaker and is, you know, is hostile to us and, you know, has used, you know, force against our own troops when we were in Iraq. It's, you know, harassed us and, you know, done terrible things to us in various ways. But for Israel, it's a much, much bigger question. And, you know, the threat of an Iranian nuclear weapon is not negligible to the rest of the world, not necessarily because the Iranians, you know, have a suicidal desire to make a first strike or anything like that. It's not that scenario that's the problem. It's rather that, you know, Iran, which is a nation which already loves to blackmail others, will have tremendous blackmail power if it has a nuclear weapon. But the Israelis really do have to think seriously about the existential threat if Iran has a nuclear weapon, partly because, you know, Israel is a very small, compact country. So in terms of population, in terms of geographic space, in terms of how much of the Israeli territory is actually not desert, right? And you can actually have a population. It's quite limited and compact, which means that it would not take a large nuclear arsenal to target the main population centers of Israel and basically annihilate Israel. So that is a danger that Israel faces that's very different from, you know, larger countries, not just like the United States or China. Famously, Mao Zedong said, look, we have so many billions of people in China and we have such a large country, even if we get in a nuclear war, we're going to survive it. And we're going to be able to, you know, have a second strike and we're going to take out our enemies. So Mao thought, you know, his country, because of its sheer size, was somewhat insulated against the logic of nuclear destruction. Iran is also a very big country, both in terms of population, about 90 million people, and in terms of its geographic footprint. And it would be much harder, even if you had nuclear parity between Iran and Israel, it would be very hard for Israel to use the same number of nuclear weapons in a way that crippled Iran as a you know, a state, relative to how easy it would be for Iran to use a similar number of nuclear weapons to completely wipe out Israel. So Israel has quite naturally been eager to have a war to stop Iran from furthering its nuclear ambitions. And that means that even if the United States, you know, isn't quite sure that we want to get into a war, Iran and Israel is going to go ahead and do it because their lives may depend on it. Well, and if Israel gets started on the war, then, you know, the United States will feel an obligation, in fact, partly a matter of honor, also, you know, a matter of you know, interest, also a matter of political pressure. There certainly is such a thing as an Israel lobby in the United States. All of these elements are going to, you know, make a case that we need to be involved in a war against Iran. If Israel's involved in a war against Iran, then we should also be involved in a war against Iran. And you saw that, you know, last year when Israel started a war that it was fighting by itself, and then subsequently the United States came in and ended the war very quickly. And you see it also now where both Israel and the United States have been partners from the beginning in this longer operation against Iran.
Hey, it's John. I've been using Marsmen for a few months now, and I honestly can say that I feel pretty good. I'm not dragging through workouts, I'm not wiped out after chasing my little girl or handling stuff around the house. As a husband and a father, I take it seriously. I want to stay strong, energized, and capable for my family. Marsmen makes that easier. It's packed with 8 powerful, clinically dosed ingredients like Pankaj Ali, Chilajit, Fenugreek, Taurine, Zinc, Boron, Vitamin D, and Vitamin K that work together to support natural testosterone, energy, strength, and recovery. Most guys don't realize it until it hits them, but during the middle age years, you start to lose some of your testosterone. Right now, listeners get a great deal, 50% off for life, free shipping, free gifts, plus their 90-day higher T guarantee. Go to mengotomars.com and grab yours today. And don't forget to let them know that Conversations That Matter sent you. God bless.
So even if our allies are leading the charge, that can be a conflict we wind up getting into. It would be the same way with NATO. You could imagine that if the Europeans did what we say we want them to do, which is to take more responsibility for their own foreign policy, this might eventually lead to a country like Poland deciding it needs to directly intervene in, you know, a conflict to, you know, neighboring it in Ukraine, and that it's going to send its own troops to go fight Russians, in which case, even though NATO is a defensive alliance and we would not be required by the alliance structure to go to war on behalf of Poland, it would still be, you know, kind of like something that looks like an incipient world war, and the United States would probably feel a very strong degree of sympathy for the Poles and would want to, you know, support them any way it could, which might ultimately drag us into the conflict. So this is just to say, you know, we may want a policy of disengagement and, you know, a peaceful policy that doesn't involve us in faraway conflicts, but the faraway conflicts aren't necessarily going to leave us alone, right? Not because they're going to, not because we're going to get invaded or anything like that, but because we really do, and this again goes back all the way to the founding, we do have sympathies for different sides, right? So during the founding era, some Americans sympathized with revolutionary France, others sympathized with Britain, and we thought it was really important to us, you know, not only for reasons of self-interest, economic or otherwise, but also for reasons of philosophy and for reasons of honor that one side win and another side lose. Americans still feel that way about many of the conflicts happening around the world today.
And we do also have all these military bases in the Middle East as well. I mean, they could attack us, but it wouldn't be our national soil. It would be our large bases that are, and why are they over there? I mean, part of it is, I know what we're experiencing right now because of the blockage of the Strait of Hormuz. It's, we want to make sure trade is flowing and that China's not the one that's influencing all of the decisions. And if they're, we want a bargaining chip, if there's something that comes up that is in our national interest. And so, I mean, I look at all of this complexity and it's like, I would love to be Fortress America, like the 80s game. Like, I just want to be here and not have to worry about the things over there. But I've wondered whether in a global economy that's even possible, let alone the conditions that we have now with bases all over the world and stuff. So, I didn't expect you to give like the silver bullet answer for here's what America can do to make both of these things a possibility. One, not have to care much about what happens in Europe and Asia and the Middle East. And two, also secure our national interests and trade policies and so forth. That seems to be the balancing act that every administration faces. And you make the case that there's been a bit of a, well, I'll let you speak to it. My interpretation was, you said there's been a bit of a wandering on what our foreign policy should be post Bush, and Trump's filled the vacuum, but this is not satisfactory to.
Yeah. So, I mean, part of the problem here is that, you know, it's a complicated enough world when you think of it in terms of, you know, material interests, economic interests, strategic considerations, like, you know, keeping waterways open. Those are difficult enough, you know, things to tackle in trying to create a foreign policy that serves the country well. And then on top of it, you have, you know, what might be called matters of imagination and sort of grand ideological visions. And one of the problems after the Cold War is that not only, you know, it was a watershed. It was really a historic choice in the early 1990s, where George H.W. Bush, you know, he had elements within his administration that were thought of as realists. They were meant to be people who considered, you know, military affairs in terms of power, in terms of interests, in terms of, you know, strategic needs. And they were not meant to be sort of ideologues who took a romantic view of what foreign policy could accomplish. The trouble is, a lot of that romanticism, and a lot of it was, you know, took the form of a certain variety of neoconservatism, that did start to creep into even the George H.W. Bush administration. And then it became very much a part of the George W. Bush administration. And, you know, curiously enough, even Bill Clinton, a Democrat, who was, you know, considered to be, he was a, you know, a protester against the Vietnam War. He was someone who was coming from what, you know, was imagined to be the anti-war left. But even Bill Clinton came to see, you know, using American power as a way to advance American ideals. Now, ideals, you know, are a good thing, you know, in the abstract. But when you conduct an idealist foreign policy, and you think that you can, you know, bring about not just stability, but also a sort of new dawn, a new world order, as George H.W. Bush said, where you are promoting, you know, your values and your way of life and your form of government all around the planet. That, unfortunately, is kind of like what the French Revolution was trying to do. It was trying to do it in a very heavy-handed way, but that was certainly what it aimed to do. And George Washington was quite right to say, wait a minute, look, I mean, we may be a republic just like France is a republic, but that doesn't mean that we have, you know, the same ideological goals and the same sort of vision for, you know, democratizing the whole planet. Well, a lot of neoconservatives did have that French Revolutionary, you know, sort of fervor. That doesn't mean they necessarily wanted to have, you know, wars as, you know, aggressive as the French Revolutions were, but they certainly did want America to use a lot of military force in pursuit of an ideal, in pursuit of a dream. And that became a big problem. And it's, you know, it can be a problem now, too. Although one of the things that I think distinguishes Trump from the Republicans who had preceded him at the end of the, you know, after the Cold War, is that Trump is not a romantic. He's not an idealist. He's someone who is transactional. And that's actually a good thing. It means he's always looking for deals, but he is willing to use force. And he does understand interests in a way that, you know, too few leading Republicans are willing to open their minds to. So, you know, Trump, I think, is, you know, certainly up until now in interventions like the one against Maduro in Venezuela, and for that matter, you know, taking out the head of IRGC back in his first term, Trump had been very, very good at using exactly the right amount of force to accomplish something significant for the United States and not overinvesting and not getting into conflicts that he seemed like he couldn't win or couldn't bring to an end. The Iran war that we're fighting right now, it's a serious war that, you know, has a proper objective in trying to stop Iran from getting a nuclear weapon. But it is obviously a much more difficult and much larger conflict than the ones that Trump has succeeded with before. And so we're in this very tough position where, you know, Trump is basically, I mean, he has a choice of either trying to strike a deal based on where things are right now, which is going to be tough because the Iranians feel like they have a lot of leverage with the Strait of Hormuz, or alternatively, he can escalate. He can send in ground troops, try to, you know, take over enough of the coast of the Red Sea that he can then, you know, open up the Straits of Hormuz and deprive Iran of that leverage. But of course, once you get on the ground in Iran, then you've got another problem because then you've got to defend your spot on the ground against, you know, the Iranians who have most of the ground on their side and most of the population as well. So, you know, Trump has to, this is going to be the greatest test of Trump's, you know, negotiating skills that we've yet encountered.
And I saw last night, I don't know where things are at this morning. I was trying to figure it out, but it every hour changes, that it seemed like, despite Netanyahu's posts online, and I think they are supportive of Trump, you know, and Netanyahu is supportive, but there's a lot of people in Israel that are not happy that Trump may strike a deal that gets the United States what we want in our interest. You know, they can't have a nuclear bomb. They're going to hand over the uranium and dispose of it. But it doesn't go farther, and we're not going to say much about their proxies that are attacking Israel and stuff. And so, I mean, this is, as far as I know right now, where it stands, that Trump seems to think we're making headway on the objectives that America has had in this, but this isn't meeting all the expectations that Israel was hoping it would meet, which if that is the way it goes down, will be interesting, to say the least. Maybe the best thing right now is to just briefly talk about the Democrats a little bit. You made the case in your post that someone like a Thomas Massie has possibilities in the Democrat Party, because the Democrat Party already has ownership or a monopoly on being anti-Zionist, anti-Israel. So it's sort of a natural fit for the people that are almost like the sort of stereotypical McCarthy when it comes to, or they're getting that way. I mean, Thomas Massie, since his loss, has been like just pointing fingers all over the place online, accusing people of taking money from Israel or whatever, even if it's not accurate. I mean, I've been watching this and I'm like, what is going on? I've quite remarkable. I've never quite seen anything like this. But, you know, is he going to become like Justin Amash or Joe Scarborough or any of these guys who went to D.C. and they just said, we just want fiscal responsibility. We want some of these libertarian objectives, smaller government. But then when they become the opposition to the Republicans, the Democrats look at them like they're darlings, which is kind of what happened to Thomas Massie. And now they've got an ideological kind of objective that they share in common. So flesh that out a little for us, if you will, because you do talk about it, that, you know, the Democrats could capitalize on this.
Yeah. So I wrote an article for Compact and also an article for The Spectator about Thomas Massie's primary election. Now, Massie himself and many of his online supporters have said, well, really, the only reason Massie lost his primary was because he was facing massive spending against him by the Israel lobby and by a number of Jewish billionaires who are pro-Israel and see Massie as an opponent of Israel, and therefore put in, you know, more than $30 million basically over the course of his race to get Massie defeated. And so that's what Massey's been pointing to. Massie, you know, makes a lot of jokes. He says his opponent, Ed Gallbrain, is basically just a tool of Israel. Massie even kicked off his concession speech, which is, you know, normally an opportunity to show that you're a gentleman and that you've taken your defeat in stride. Instead, Massie kicked off his concession speech by saying that he just got off the phone to Israel because that's the only place, you know, you can reach Ed Gallbrain, his opponent. So this is something that Massie has taken very, very personally. And as I say, he and his most diehard supporters attribute all of his, all the reason for his defeat to the spending by supporters of Israel. Now, one question or several questions that emerge from that. First of all, it's kind of odd for libertarians of all people to suddenly have a problem with campaign finance spending, right? So libertarians famously are opposed to restrictions on wealthy people being able to give money in political elections. Does that rule suddenly not apply if the people giving the money are Jewish or if Israel is the cause that they want to support? So that's, you know, a kind of question about, you know, just where is principled libertarianism going there? One could also say that, well, maybe it's not, maybe, you know, people aren't, you know, supporters of Thomas Massie aren't going to call for new laws to prevent billionaires from giving money to support Israel. But maybe they're just going to say, well, we're going to talk about this and call it out and then, you know, kind of shame billionaires into not being able to support Israel. But that's what Massie tried to do in his primary. I mean, he certainly talked about it a lot, and yet he's still lost. And Massie himself, you know, admits that, you know, in his way of thinking, the spending, you know, counted for much more than his talking about the spending. in terms of, you know, which way voters decided to go. So just talking about it the way Massey talked about it, which was often quite bitter and harsh, that didn't succeed. So I asked in one of my articles, what's the next level then? Are you going to escalate this? Are you going to, start talking about Israel and not just Israel, but Americans who support Israel, which is going to include a great many American Jews. It's also going to include, you know, some American, Christian Zionists and others. Are you going to start talking about them explicitly as enemies and, you know, say that this is all, you know, a foreign element, which is now hijacking our elections, and we need to, you know, be on guard against this kind of subversion? If you start taking that kind of rhetoric, too far, you're going to be very hard to distinguish from, you know, an out-and-out anti-Semite. So there are real, you know, I'm not trying to say here that, you know, people who are criticizing Israel or people who are criticizing the billionaires are anti-Semites, because I don't think that's true. What I am saying is that they have put themselves in an escalatory spiral, which, if they're not careful, is going to lead people around them in a direction that's going to start, you know, being indistinguishable from anti-Semitism. So that's a real, you know, moral problem and a problem on a number of levels. I don't think that Massey lost his primary because of the spending against him. It certainly didn't help. But if you think of what, you know, was basically at stake in Massey's primary, as far as the ordinary Republican primary voter was concerned, Massey had defined himself, you know, kind of in three ways. Massey was a big critic of Donald Trump. He was someone who was supporting the release of the Epstein files and was doing that, it looked like, precisely because he wanted to embarrass Trump. He had voted against the One Big Beautiful Bill, which was the most important piece of domestic, sort of spending and tax cut legislation that Trump has championed, which again, you know, places Massey against Trump. And Massey was also asking Republican primary voters to basically produce a referendum on whether they had positive feelings towards Israel or negative feelings towards Israel. And if you know anything at all about Republican primary voters, all three of those questions, you know, if you had no Israel, you know, no pro-Israel spending at all in the primary, and you just asked ordinary Republican primary voters, are you pro-Trump or pro-Massey? Do you see the release of the Epstein files as being just something Massey is doing for, you know, the sake of fighting, you know, child abuse? Or do you see this as something he's doing to embarrass Trump? And if you ask them, do you like Israel or do you dislike Israel? On all three of those questions, anyone who knows the first thing about Republican primary voters anywhere in the country is going to say, of course, primary voters are going to choose Trump over Massey. So he had, you know, kind of put himself in a corner and kept reinforcing a message that was guaranteed to get him to lose his primary. And again, you know, the spending by the billionaires certainly, you know, added fuel to that fire. And, you know, that's probably a big reason why he lost, not just lost, but lost by 10 points. But, you know, the idea that you would single out this spending coming from a few billionaires rather than looking at the fact that you're actually at war with your president and your party, that I think is foolish. Now, what I say is that I think the people who are most inclined to reject what I've just said and who want to focus purely on Israel and reject the idea that, alienation from his president and his party was a big part of Massey's defeat. I think people who view this purely through the lens of Zionism or anti-Zionism have to ask themselves, where is anti-Zionism going to have the best political future? If that's the most important issue, is that going to be a successful issue in Republican primaries, or is it going to be more successful in Democratic primaries? And if you look at the condition of the Democratic Party right now, it seems to me that that is the party that is most open to anti-Zionism. That's the party where the strongest criticisms of Israel will probably find the most favorable reception.
Well, I'm an hour and a half, 2 hours north of New York City right now. So I just saw this play out with the New York City race. Mamdani, that was one of his main issues. It's interesting to see that at a local level where it shouldn't really matter, but it does to the Democrat voters quite a bit. So, that's a spot on analysis. And, you know, I don't know if you're aware, I don't know how much you are online, but that is kind of what you just described Massey doing. That is what he was doing. I think it was just yesterday with Turning Point USA, trying to insinuate that their distributor is, I think it was Salem Media, and Salem Media is pro-Israel, and it wasn't true. And Turning Point USA pointed this out, but then Candace Owens got in on it, and it was a big kind of thing online over the weekend. And I just thought, man, this is so sad for me to see this because, I mean, I don't know how long, I mean, I'm sure just being in politics, you followed Massey for a while, but he's always struck me as someone who had some conviction. I liked a lot of the small government talk. And to see him doing this kind of thing right now, it feels like he's spending whatever kind of built up respect that he's had on really cheap fights that aren't helping him in his political future in the Republican Party, at least. And where's this all going? Do you have a prediction for us? I mean, you sort of said that the Democrats are going to be able to capitalize on this kind of energy more and more. But do you see a fusion forming? Because I've heard Tucker Carlson talk about this. I've even heard Nick Fuentes talk about this, that there is an alignment that decent people have where if we just softened over here on the free market stuff, and if the Democrats were just able to meet us a little bit on the immigration stuff, we could have this sort of decent people's coalition that would transcend Republican and Democrat. I don't see that ever happening, but I'm curious if you have any thoughts on that.
Well, it's very interesting that Thomas Massey started to get favorable coverage in places like The New Yorker, The New York Times, The Atlantic, even among neoconservatives at The Bulwark, which is the publication of Bill Kristol. Massey, who, you know, until, you know, about a year ago was, you know, considered to be either irrelevant or, you know, a kind of kooky libertarian guy or an outright enemy by most of these, you know, kind of establishment liberal and neocon voices, suddenly they changed their attitude towards him. And something I've been trying to get, you know, a lot of Massey's fans to understand is these people who've suddenly, you know, decided they like Massey, just like they suddenly decided they like Marjorie Taylor Greene. These are smart, sophisticated people. And if they're changing their tune on someone, that's probably not because they have suddenly decided that, hey, libertarianism is great, you know, small government is great, we like what Massey's saying about, you know, constitutionalism. On the contrary, what it's telling you is that these people see something that is in the advantage of their existing ideology at stake in Massey's reelection. And they favor Massey over the critics of Massey. They favor Massey over Donald Trump. So I've just, you know, try to get Massey supporters to think about what else is at stake there. Massey supporters, you know, I understand where they're coming from. They want to view this in terms of Massey being a good, strict constitutionalist, which is true. They want to view this in terms of smaller government, which, you know, Massey is also a champion of. And they don't want to look at how those issues, which are generally not things that actually have any effect on what happens in Washington, D.C., right? So Massey is usually a lone vote in protest. He's not someone who's leading legislation that's shrinking the government. Nevertheless, I mean, he conducts himself honorably, and he has a, you know, with respect to the size of government, and he has, you know, a very consistent small government philosophy. But there are people who can use Massey and use his views and use the way he speaks as a weapon against Donald Trump and as a weapon in the fights that actually do have consequences in Washington, D.C. You know, fights about limited government virtually never have any consequences in Washington, D.C., because the sad truth is virtually no one in either party, you know, supports actually limited government. Massey is an exception to that. Massey does really support limited government, but he's one guy, and you can't do anything with one guy. This is another thing that, you know, I've kind of made a key part of my essay for Compact. If you really believe that we need to have limited government, and I think a lot of us do, then you actually have to have friends. You actually have to have a political party where, you know, lots of people believe that, and you can coordinate, you know, in terms of getting the policies you want. You can't just elect one guy and think, hey, this is fine, or have, you know, three or four guys, Rand Paul and Massey and Amash, and think that that's going to be enough. You've got to, you know, elect more people. That means you're probably going to have to make alliances and trade-offs with some Republicans who aren't as hardcore as you, and maybe even don't share your prime principles. And you're going to have to learn from Donald Trump and be transactional. You're going to have to trade off, you know, okay, maybe you're not going to oppose one bill, but you're going to do that in order to get support for another. This is not what, you know, guys like Thomas Massey or, you know, even for the most part, Rand Paul are willing to do. So they're not real politicians in that sense. Now, Ron Paul is kind of the original model of this, the Texas congressman. And I think, you know, Ron Paul knew what he was doing. He knew that he was not, you know, building a sort of party within a party for the sake of liberty during his, you know, long tenure in Congress. He was, you know, basically as a congressman trying to be an educator rather than a legislator, and that's fine. There is a place for that. And he also, even to the extent that he didn't want to, you know, take over the Republican Party for the longest time, he nonetheless would vote for, you know, the Republican speaker, whoever the candidate might be. He generally wasn't trying to shake things up, you know, when it came to leadership elections and other things that are extremely sensitive when it comes to, you know, the party's internal apparatus. I understand what, you know, people inspired by Ron Paul were trying to do. You know, I was part of Ron Paul's 2008 presidential campaign. I thought, you know, it was great to see Ron Paul inspire a number of Republicans to run for office as limited government Republicans, you know, in you know, the same era of the Tea Party. And in fact, the Tea Party really has some of its origins in Ron Paul. That was all great. But unfortunately, people very quickly, you know, who were involved in that effort decided, well, this is enough, you know, getting one senator in, getting, you know, two congressmen, getting some state legislators elected. That's enough. And now we can, you know, call the shots, perhaps in the Republican Party and in the country as a whole. And in fact, it was nowhere near enough. You actually have to be much more, you have to talk to a lot more people and you know, either win them over to your cause or make allies of them through transactions than the Liberty Movement was ever able to do. And of course, Donald Trump has shown you can do it and you can do it very quickly. But you have to have, you know, some of the transactional qualities that Trump has. You can't just be a philosophical purist.
Well, I think the moral of the story then is look at the full picture and look at the Republican Party, even as this is a tool. This is a step in the right direction, even if you don't agree with everything it's standing for or doing. You have to look at all the alternatives and you have to then negotiate and navigate a world where it's not going to be perfect. It's not all philosophical and ideological. It really is messy. And that's the world Donald Trump seems to thrive in. He likes that. He likes to be in the boardroom and work people over and try to get whatever his policy objective is using whatever means necessary. And this is something maybe that could be learned from. So I appreciate that. This has really been a helpful, I think, clarifying and educating and enlightening discussion, Daniel. And I want people to know where they can find your stuff. So Modern Age, you can go to, is it modernage.com, I think, is the website?
Modernagejournal.com.
Modernagejournal.com, modernagejournal.com. Yes. Check that out. And you can check out all of Daniel McCarthy's essays and also the podcast, right? Do you still host a podcast? I know you were doing that.
Yeah, I did a podcast for about a year for the Intercollegiate Studies Institute. And that is now wrapped up, but I'm sure I will have new podcasting opportunities in the near future.
So you're a guest on people's podcasts more so.
I'm a guest, yeah. And I'm a guest on many shows, and I'm always grateful for it. So thank you.
All right. Well, very good. Thank you, Daniel. God bless you.